Live and in color from the NBC News radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel from the Turf Sup radio studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning into the Water Zone show this evening. Hi, good evening. I'm Rob Starr, one of your hosts, and my other famous host over here is Mr. Chris Davies. Chris, how are you?
I'm splendid tonight, man. I got to say, you look awesome, too, man. That shiny shirt you had on. You must have been doing something more important earlier today.
I had a couple of meetings. I'm working with Weiland Foundation and
right.
A lady named Pam Pavella, who's in charge of conservation at Western Municipal Water, and we're writing a book.
Yep.
And so we had a meeting about that, and then I had to go to a conference, a medical conference, later on in the day, and give a speech about all kinds of things, and like extracorporeal membrane oxygenation and stuff like that. And
yeah, say that three times fast.
No, and how that applies to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and stuff. Quite different than irrigation, but it's irrigation in your body. It's your heart stuff.
Yeah, a little bit different. Well, you do look snazzy, man, on that jacket with the little pocket kerchief
you like
in there.
That? I think that my wife, it looked nice. She picked it
out. Golly, man, you look sharp, buddy.
Well, I have to represent Toro pretty nice.
Yeah,
and the reason for the medical stuff is because some people know that we make medical tubing processing and things of that sort with electro beam machines and things. But it's always fun doing something different. And I appreciate the diversity of things that I do every day. But what I really like is this.
Yeah, me too.
It's a good fun thing. We have a great show tonight.
Yeah, I do indeed.
We have two smart ladies on. We always have the one smart lady on, Miss Chris Austin. And then we have another one who's a PhD in physics, and we'll talk to her in a little bit. And we'll have a great conversation with her. She works for the United States Geological Survey, and we'll give her background and stuff when it comes up. But I want to bring our first smart lady on, who's always brilliant and knows everything about water, even though she says she doesn't. She does. I want to bring Chris Austin on. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
All right.
We're doing fine.
We're doing awesome. Thanks very much. Your mic was a little high in our headphones here, so both of us.
No, you were fine. We had our engineer.
I could dominate.
No, you can dominate. No, the engineer. We had our engineer turn our headphones up before the show started, and then your mic was up, and all of a sudden, woo!
We're giving Freddie the thumbs up. It's good now.
It's okay, Freddie. Freddie's a good guy. He's a keeper.
Online saw you jump 10 feet up, right?
What's the way to get the attention?
Yeah, exactly. Cool.
So I'm driving to work this morning, and on the news it says, hey, we're heading for a drought. 46% of the state is either in a drought or going into one.
Or the driest, the driest beginning of the calendar year.
January and February.
For Los Angeles.
Yeah, for Los Angeles County. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's great around the state. No, precipitation is definitely down. It's hard to get excited when we get when we get a really wet fall, because that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to continue raining. And so many times, kind of as it has, it dries up on January 1st. And, you know, so here we are, middle of February, and it's not looking good. There's not much rain on the horizon. However, you have to keep in mind that California water comes, we just need a handful of storms per year. And sometimes those storms do come in March and sometimes into April. You know, the March miracle, the awesome April, we kind of have coined these words in the past, and that may happen again. Or, again, it may not, because certainly Jerry Brown was standing, 4 or 5, or however long it was ago, he's standing at where there was supposed should have been, feet of snow, and he was standing on dry ground. So, you know, it's really what matters is what we have on the ground on April 1st.
Yep.
But, and so should you start freaking out about drought right now? Probably not, because, a handful of storms can change the outlook. But that doesn't mean, you should turn on your taps and fling water around your house as if, the unicorns with the water that flow from their heads. You know, I mean, that's you talk about endangered species. It's, you know, the unicorns. That they've really, you know, that's, those are the worst. But anyways.
They are. Chase them away from my yard all the time.
I know. So, you know, it's like, you know, you can't really say at this point which way it's going to go. So I would say be overly depressed, but don't be overly confident either. I mean, we're just going to have to play it all out.
Yeah. Chris here is laughing because my chair is squeaking.
Yes, it is. Every time. Shift a little bit.
some of the things that people, I guess the people who are watching us on television can see that, but you know, I think the best part is when don't do your chair thing. he just shrunk 3 feet.
So the other big story actually I guess it was last week, was that the Newsom administration finally released their framework for these what they're called the voluntary agreement.
Yes.
Although it's been pointed out to me that not everybody has agreed to these agreements.
No.
You know, how much you can really call them voluntary agreements at this point. But they released these. And, you know, for some, the water agencies are generally supportive. The environmentalists are really kind of mixed, and actually some haven't even weighed in yet, which I don't think bodes well. You know, so we'll see where this goes, and there's still quite a long ways to go. These voluntary agreements have to be analyzed by the State Water Board, and they have to figure out how they would turn these things into something that's like enforceable through a water quality control plan. And, you know, from the State Water Board aspect, a water quality control plan generally contains things like water quality objectives for salinity or, you know, contaminants or freshwater flows. They don't necessarily directly translate into things that are on the table for the voluntary agreements, like, you know, habitat restoration and all these things. So there kind of has to be sort of this reconciliation, I would call it, between what is being proposed in the voluntary agreements, which we could, let's just label that a 21st century sort of solution, to our regulations, which were really formed back in the late 20th century, and they're kind of different. You know, there's a lot of things that we need to be changing with our ideas of water management, especially in the face of climate change, or whatever you want to call it. You know, things are changing in the system, and things are changing in the Delta and in other parts of the system faster than we can, from a regulatory standpoint, respond to things. And this means that, you know, we are going to lose species. We are going to lose things that we care about if we cannot move fast enough.
Well, so what you're really summing, to sum this up, is on our 10th anniversary show, we'll have an answer to all of this.
We will. You will?
I don't know. Probably not.
Might want to be careful what you promise.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had someone say to me, you know, when I was talking to them about climate change, and they said, well, what if you're wrong? Okay, well, you know what? One thing we're not wrong about is that things are changing. You talk to growers, you talk to people, they may not want to call it climate change, but things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's undeniable. And we need to respond to that. And droughts are going to become, and we can certainly, everybody in their recent memory can tag on to a drought. Droughts are going to become more frequent. And whether you don't want to believe in climate change, history, just look at the last 7 years here in California, I guess my years are off. Think back the last 10 years. We've had more drought years than we have had non-drought years. And that is a fact. That's not conjecture. And so the things that we might do to prepare for climate change are also the things that we might do to prepare for more continued drought.
Right.
So, you know, it's never a bad idea to invest in solutions or things that can help you go through a drought. But it does mean that things are going to cost more. And I was working on taking down a presentation on groundwater management, and the speaker was saying, you know, yeah, all these things are going to cost money. So,
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Guess what? You know, get prepared to open your wallet. And that's going to trickle down to the water users, and nobody likes to pay more for, you know, the things that they need. But, you know, we're going to need to make some moves here on water. Whether you believe in climate change or not, certainly anybody who looks at the last 10 years in California can see that drought is becoming a more of an issue. And preparing for drought is what you got to do, whether you want to call it preparing for climate change or not.
No,
that's what we got to do.
No, it's more prevalent, and I just want to see us move forward with something. Maybe we don't solve it 100%, but there's no forward motion. It's just discussion.
No, well, there's really two options here, right? You either slow down the growth, the changes, and all the stuff that's going that's going on, or you speed up the velocity of the state's response, whether it be regulatory or not, right?
Right.
And certainly all of that, but you know, because we're talking, you know. To those in, you know, the San Bernardino Redlands area, you should also be aware that in that area, they have been very forward thinking on preparing for drought. And in the San Bernardino Valley area, they've completed some projects. They've, you know, like the Seven Oaks Dam, which actually brought in new water into the, you know, into the Santa Ana River Basin, and you know, they've completed other projects there. They completed their end of the state water project. They are now recharging water into the aquifer. So the people in the Santa Ana Basin are doing what they need to do to be prepared for the drought.
Weren't you at Seven Oaks Dam just a few months ago?
I was. I gave the keynote speech when they opened up that that project. But, I mean, really, the state should really be looking to the solutions that the people in the Santa Ana watershed, you know, what they put together, the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority and all of those water suppliers in that basin, because they've come together and, you know, they have a groundwater committee because they understood that while they had a groundwater adjudication, which is the judge that went in there and said, well, here's how much water you all can pump, they realized that even so, their groundwater levels were declining and they had to address that. So they've come together, they formed a committee, and they're working together. There's so much positive coming out of that Santa Ana Basin and all the organizations that are working in there, and the way that they have come together to work together to solve the region's problems. That's really key. I'll tell you, you know, just to, you know, key off to something, it's also what they did in the Sacramento area many years ago, where all the water suppliers got together. And they figured out, and there was a whole bunch of them, like, I don't know, 26 different water agencies in the basin. And they came together and they started talking about, well, what happens if we have no water in Folsom Dam? You know, who are our water suppliers that depend on water in Folsom Dam and how would we get water to them. And they started to figure out how they could interconnect all their water systems together. And then when the big drought happened and there was no water in Folsom Dam, while they didn't have all the infrastructure in place, all the water suppliers had already been talking to each other, so they got together and they figured out how to get water to the water districts that needed it, which included some temporary water pipelines that they, you know, that they strung across. But they knew what they had to do, and they figured out temporary solutions where they hadn't had built the full infrastructure. And so when all that went down, they had already been in the room together, and they already were talking to each other, and they knew what to do. And that's the same kind of thing that's been going on in the Santa Ana Basin with all your agencies there. And that's something that you all should take real pride in.
Yeah,
because
I think
when it gets real tough, they get in the same room and they know each other and they can talk it out.
Yeah, I think we're going to do that. We're Rob and I are going to plan a party, I think. No, but up there where you were at, I mean, that was a couple of dozen agencies getting together and coming to terms with this and making some decisions,
yep.
Right? I mean, that's pretty significant. That's a success story.
Yeah, well, in the Sacramento Basin, you know, it actually all started, I'm going to think, about 20 years ago when the environmentalists were all mad about all the water that was being taken out of the rivers,
mm-hmm.
and the water agencies wanted to fuel the growth of the, you know, Sacramento area, and they were kind of coming head-to-head in court on a lot of these things, and then they said, you know what, let's get together. And so they created this thing called the Water Forum, and it was sort of an area where outside of the courts they got together and they hammered out some agreements. And in those agreements, that was sort of led the seed for all the water agencies to get together and figure out how to solve their common problems. Not only was that infrastructure, but it was groundwater management, too. And they kind of came together and they figured it out. And the key is figuring it out before it's a crisis.
Yeah.
Because when everyone's stressed and you're worried about your own agency, your own district, and your own people, your own constituents, and you walk into the room for the first time with all these other people who are worried about all their own constituents, it's a really hard conversation. It's much easier if you all know each other and you met before.
Yeah, the pressure's off,
Yeah. Because then you can get together and you can say, well, this is really what I need, and you know, and this is where we come to solutions.
Yeah,
and
if they can do it ahead of time, and, you know, I mean, there's the stress of, as you said earlier, adjudication coming down the pike and saying, well, this is what you're going to do, right? So you avoid that.
Yeah. And, you know, who's to say that adjudication, I mean, you go in there and now you've got a judge. And do you think the judge is a hydrologist? I mean, how much is the judge going to know about setting sustainable yields for a groundwater basin? I mean, he'll rely on experts
or
whatever, but I think, you know, it's much better. Any collaborative project is going to be a lot better than just a judge making a decision.
Oh, that's why there's appeal courts.
Yeah, and, you know, actually what's really funny is I went on the 1st, of February, I was in San Francisco for an event called the California Water Law Symposium, which is a great event put on by 6 law schools in primarily the San Francisco Bay Area, but also there's one in Sacramento, and it rotates every year. And the students set up panels. And so the discussion this year was on federalism and, you know, California water relations. And the keynote speaker was retired Deputy Attorney General from California named Clifford Lee. And he told the story at the end about the San Joaquin River restoration process. And this court case came before this judge, I believe it's Judge Lawrence Carlton, and it was the United States versus the not keeping salmon in good condition below Frye and Dam. In fact, 60 miles of the river had gone dry, and the salmon were essentially dead. And so, or extirpated would be the word. And so the judge divided it up into two sections. One was, you know, responsibility, and the other one was remedy. So he got to the end of the first part, and he said, yes, United States federal government, you are responsible for keeping salmon in good condition. And then, as Clifford Lee tells it, when he moves to the remedy part, so he brings all the parties in, and he was looking at the federal U.S. attorneys, and he's like, look, I have a very blunt instrument to fashion a solution here. In fact, you could call it a meat cleaver. So if you want me to use my meat cleaver to make a decision here, and he was really looking at the U.S. attorneys, he's like, go ahead. You know, I, as a federal judge, I'm required to do that. But I suggest you all go into the room and figure out something to do. And, you know, and I'll give you a year, and we'll schedule a trial date here. And if it's, you know, you haven't gotten there, you come back here, and I'll use my meat cleaver.
Probably good advice.
And although they had to get a couple of extensions there, wouldn't you know, they came to an agreement, and it was a much better agreement than the judge with his meat cleaver could have accomplished.
Was the judge a Moyle?
No, actually, it was the federal judge in the Eastern Circuit. I guess the guy, Lawrence Carlton, was kind of known to be a bit of a curmudgeon. I guess curmudgeon would be a tough word.
Well, I'm still looking up that word about those fish on my in my Funkin' Wagnalls dictionary here.
Extirpated.
Yes, whatever that is.
Yeah. It means they're not necessarily extinct as a species, okay, but they are extinct in that particular part of their habitat.
All right.
I believe that's coming off the top of my head.
Okay. All right, Chris. Well, hey, tell everybody a little bit about Maven's Notebook and where they can reach you and get to hear some more information
how to be a subscriber and everything else.
Right.
Hey, yeah, Maven's Notebook, the only place to go for California water news as far as I'm concerned.
That's right.
At www.mavensnotebook.com. Right on.
Yep.
There we go.
And please,
right,
please be a subscriber, and I'm telling you, you get the best news right off the bat. She puts it out faster than the newspapers put it out.
Yep. If you want to know it before anybody else,
that's right,
check
I'd
Maven's
love to
Notebook
be first.
Oh, we
say
I'm
all
first
about being first.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you. Actually, next week's an ag show, so we'll talk to you the week after.
Yeah.
And,
well, I'll talk to you, but I'm still on next week with England.
Oh, yes, you are.
Oh, that's
aren't
right.
You?
That's
yep,
right.
She,
that's
yep,
right.
She
that's
is. Right. We saw the show makeup. Yep. So yep. Yeah.
I didn't see the makeup part.
Yep. So she's on with.
Okay,
she's invited in.
Excellent.
All right. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be back after the station break with a great guest from the U.S. Geological Survey. Stay with us.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, Would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes. A better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
Hey, Green Industry Pros, are you new to Turf Sup Radio and want to learn more? Then plug in your earphones and keep listening, because Turf Sup Radio invites you to listen while you work. Our 24/7 live radio platform keeps you up to date, bringing you new tips and interviews from pros like you who want to elevate and educate the green industry. Can't make it to industry shows or events? Don't worry, Turf Sup Radio will be there bringing you live coverage, getting you in on the action. So keep listening to Turf Sup Radio, your industry, your station.
All right, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone Show. That was great with Chris. Chris is always interesting and brings us the best
she's
in
awesome.
News. And speaking of awesome, we have our next guest, which is awesome. And she's a pretty smart lady. This
I would
coming
say,
on
next reading the credits here.
Absolutely. Her name is Dr. Morgan Page, and she's interested in probabilistic hazard analysis and inverse problems in seismology. I said that all in one breath. In particular, her research has focused on statistical issues. I'm sorry, making me laugh. We were joking earlier. Sorry, I apologize for that. In seismology, including rigorously incorporating model uncertainty into hazard analysis, quantifying uncertainty in kinematic inversions, and analyzing non-stationary rarities in earthquake catalogs. And I understand that Dr. Morgan likes to solve puzzles. Is that true?
Oh, yes. I love puzzles. I live for crossword puzzles, riddles, escape rooms. I even built an escape room in my house.
So oh, pretty
I'm pretty
cool.
obsessed. Yeah.
Well, sorry. I was laughing in the thing. We had, I don't know if you heard the previous discussion. She was talking about a federal judge with a meat cleaver. And we started busting up a gut here. It was kind of funny. I kept thinking about it. I'm looking at Chris and his face was ready to blow. So I had to compose myself. Anyway, how did you get in? I mean, your degrees are in math and physics, but how did you choose your current career path? What made you go into what you're doing now?
It was just serendipity, basically. I went to college in Iowa, and I studied astrophysics, actually, as an undergrad, and thought about maybe doing that in grad school. Came out to California, to Santa Barbara for grad school, and I went to a really fascinating talk. It was about the Morgan Hill earthquake and modeling the complex history of slip underground during that earthquake, and I was really interested, and so I started working on a project about that earthquake.
Now, you know, when my kids were going to college, they wanted to go to UCSB. Is that was where you went?
Yeah.
And they told me not to go, not to send my kids there because it was a party school.
It is for the undergrads.
That's a truism. Okay.
Definitely.
Good reply, Morgan.
Yeah. Great.
I mean, there's a whole thing of, you know, undergrads like set couches on fire in the street. You know, that's just what they do.
That's crazy. So as a research geophysicist, what's your you're classified as a statistical seismologist, which is an interesting characterization. And kind of what is that? And then if you can tell me about the marriage of statistical and geological methods.
Sure. So statistical seismologists, typically we're not looking at just one earthquake and all the details of that particular earthquake. We look at whole groups of earthquakes, maybe thousands, hundreds of thousands of earthquakes, and look for patterns that could be in their occurrence, like the timing, where they occur, relationships between. So it's basically, we were talking about puzzles earlier, it's looking for patterns, it's solving puzzles with huge amounts of earthquakes.
And data.
So earthquake catalogs. So maybe I might do a project where I'm just looking at earthquakes in California, or I'll look at earthquakes globally and look for ways in which they're all the same and ways in which they're different, so that we can better predict which areas might have earthquakes in the future.
So as a fellow physicist like myself, I believe in God we trust, all others bring data.
Definitely.
So you can always. Data is the most important thing.
Yeah. I am not a physicist, so I'll let you know that right off the bat, Morgan. Although I did take several geology classes and did well, understanding what plate tectonics were and all that stuff many years ago. Let's get into the difference between what is earthquake forecasting versus earthquake prediction, because I know there's a distinction there, and it's a very and sometimes it may be a disguised one, other times it may be acute. So maybe you can give us a little view and look at that, at the difference between the two.
Right. Well, we tend to avoid the P word as seismologists, the prediction word, because it's a really kind of sordid history with people trying to predict earthquakes very accurately. So people looking for some sort of precursor that could tell us an earthquake is going to happen in the next hour, or maybe the next day. And so really we have no method that can do what we would call prediction, which means tell you with enough accuracy when an earthquake is going to happen that you would actually, evacuate a city, say. What we do is earthquake forecasting. And the difference is between that and prediction is it's way more wishy-washy. It's more about probabilities of earthquakes changing in time and in space than predicting exactly when one is going to occur. So we might be able to tell you, based on the activity we've just observed in an area, the earthquake probability went up from, 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 100. Mm. 1 in 100 is still a really small number, chance of a big earthquake, let's say. It's a lot harder to come up with actionable numbers.
There is when I drive, I listen to KNX News because I like to listen to what's going on with traffic and so forth. And they had somebody, and I forget the name of the company up in the Bay Area, who developed some software that they're using that says they can predict an earthquake and alert people ahead of time and tell them how big it's going to be and all that. Have you heard of that?
That's different. So that sounds like it's earthquake early warning, which is real and is legitimate.
Okay.
Shake alert.
Yes, shake alert, exactly. So the idea behind earthquake early warning is that seismic waves travel much slower through the Earth than telecommunications, which travel at the speed of light.
Right.
So if you're not right at the epicenter, if you're maybe 10, 20 miles away from the epicenter, we can detect that an earthquake has happened and alert you on your phone or on your computer before the waves reach you. So maybe we can give you a few seconds of warning. You can duck under the table, your surgeon can remove his scalpel or whatever may be happening. We can slow down trains. Those kinds of actions could potentially, even though you only have a few seconds, prevent damage.
Yeah, there was some experience with that in the recent Ridgecrest. I want to say Northridge, but with the Ridgecrest earthquake, right? The M7.1 that was what was that impact back in October or so, or September?
Yeah.
September 30th, the end of the month. Did that work well? I mean, I have Shake Alert on my phone, but I can't remember getting a warning.
So at that time, the statewide app wasn't yet released.
Okay.
We only had the LA County app, and the intensities that they predicted with the Shake Alert system weren't strong enough to set anyone's phones off in LA.
In LA.
We didn't really, unfortunately, didn't get to have what would have been a really good test of the system. So they've since lowered the threshold, so they're going to alert for intensity 3, which is still pretty low shaking and probably wouldn't cause damage. But I think that's more what people want, is they want warning even if they're going to feel it, even if it wouldn't be strong enough to damage.
Yeah. So keeping on earthquakes and not using the P word, but using forecasting, right? Everything is measured in what most of us know, or we hear on the news, or we read in the newspapers, or online and social media, called the Richter scale, right? So that's the Gutenberg Richter magnitude scale, actually, is what it is. Can you give our listeners kind of like the, here's the 101 for what that scale is?
And just to add to that, I know they put sensors all over the place in the ground. So is that to get the Richter reading, do they collect an abundance of scattered data to then determine what the final one is, or how does that work?
Yeah. So we install seismic stations all over, and to record the seismic waves from an earthquake, then we can estimate its size, that's the magnitude. We can estimate its location, both latitude, longitude, its depth. And other things about the earthquake, like how strong the ground shaking from that earthquake was. And so one of the things you always hear is what magnitude the earthquake is, and that's actually a logarithmic scale. So it's the logarithm of the energy is the magnitude. And what that means is you just go up a little bit in magnitude, it's way more energy. So if you go from a magnitude 6 earthquake up to a magnitude 7 earthquake, that's 32 times more energy. And magnitude 8 was even another 32 times more energy than a magnitude 7. So it's just tremendously different, even one unit of magnitude, in terms of the energy released and how bad the shaking and hence the damage would be.
So the Earth moves, just a generic question. The Earth has little quakes all the time. But sometimes there's a small one, say a level of magnitude 3. Can that trigger a big one versus a big one following by aftershocks?
Yeah, all earthquakes can trigger other earthquakes, even if they're small. So we actually model, this brings about how we model earthquakes, which is we actually model them as epidemics. Same as with, coronavirus,
right?
Where one person can spread the virus to a number of other people, and then those people in turn can spread the virus, and it can spread throughout the population. Earthquakes are like that in a way. Each earthquake can have its own aftershock, and then those earthquakes can then have their own aftershocks, and so on and so forth. So if you've been following the coronavirus news, there's a lot of talk of this R-naught parameter, which is basically how many people on average does one person infect, and if that's higher, it means it's going to spread faster through the population. And earthquakes are like that too. There's actually a similar criticality parameter, we call it, which is how active an aftershock sequence is and how many of those aftershocks each earthquake has. And the bigger the earthquake, the more aftershocks it will tend to have. So the biggest earthquakes are the super spreaders in a way. They're having all sorts of aftershocks. You get these long, protracted aftershock sequences. But even small earthquakes can have aftershocks,
So
even the magnitude 3.
So does the decay of an earthquake tell you anything different besides how long it takes to fade away? But does it mean there's more coming? Or?
Well, certain aftershock sequences seem to have different parameters that describe how the productivity of the aftershock sequence. So there are some sequences like Ridgecrest, for example, in California last year was fairly typical aftershock sequence. But then just a few weeks ago, there's been an aftershock sequence in Puerto Rico, and it's been extremely active, way more active than we would expect for an earthquake of that size. And so because of that, the probability of that earthquake is going to trigger something even bigger is a lot larger for that sequence. So kind of like the differences from one virus to another, some viruses, because of the infectivity, is that the word, infectiousness?
Yeah.
Of the virus spread more easily through the population and spread faster.
All right. You know, another interesting thing to get into when in studying of earthquakes, and I know that it's true for many people that I talk to, right, getting back to plate tectonics, is the location of past earthquakes really the whole story? And does that tell us where the next one will come from, or are they repeatable? Or,
right.
Once it's sort of released the stress, does it go away for, another couple of hundred years? What's sort of the story with that?
Well, the locations of past earthquakes tell you a lot. So because earthquakes cluster in space, where earthquakes have been in the past, those areas are much more likely to have future earthquakes. But we can't just use that information in our models because there's some weird things. If you look at California, for example, there's parts of the San Andreas Fault that have almost no little earthquakes on them. So with our network, we can detect earthquakes down to magnitude 1, really small earthquakes that you couldn't even feel. Mm. And some of these areas, even on the San Andreas, have almost no earthquakes, but we know they're very hazardous because San Andreas is accumulating a lot of stress each year, and it has big earthquakes every 150 years or so. So we can't just look at where the little earthquakes are in our models. We also have to look at where the faults are and how quickly those faults are being stressed.
Where would you say in California is the most hazardous place for an earthquake to occur?
Definitely the place where the biggest earthquakes can happen is probably the San Andreas Fault system, which includes, in Southern California, also the San Jacinto Fault. And as it goes into Northern California, also the Hayward Calaveras, which kind of branches off from the San Andreas. Those are all the faults in California that are accumulating stress at the fastest rate.
All right. So Rob is on the ocean side of the San Andreas Fault, and I'm on the land side of it. So maybe I'll get tie up the boat.
So you'll be my neighbor.
My dock, yeah.
I'll float up to your house.
Yeah. So how about this one? Maybe this is a myth or not, but a lot of people believe, you know, that earthquakes kind of occur in groups, like, you know, three at a time sort of a thing. Is any truth to that?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Earthquakes tend to form in groups or clusters, and that means there are a lot of earthquakes going on, that ups your probability of more earthquakes and also ups your probability of a big earthquake.
When you say big, how big is big?
Well, we think we can have earthquakes up to the low magnitude 8s in California. So if the whole San Andreas were to go, that'd be about 8.3 to maybe 8.5.
Wow.
And up in Cascadia, which is the very northern tip of California and Oregon and Washington, there they have a subduction zone, and they can have earthquakes up to magnitude 9.
Wow.
So these are very unlikely earthquakes compared to, like, Northridge-size events.
Right.
You know, just a 6.7.
Yeah.
And you know how I was saying earlier that every unit of magnitude you go up, there's way more energy? Well, they also become way less likely.
Mm-hmm.
So every unit of magnitude you go up, it becomes 10 times less likely. So there are, you know, 100 magnitude 6 earthquakes for every 1 magnitude 8. So we're going to see a lot more Northridge-size events before we see, you know, the big one, most likely. We worry about the big one because it would be a regional-scale disaster. But in most places, it's the moderate-sized earthquake right underneath you.
Well,
the biggest reason to worry.
I lived in San Fernando Valley when they had that Northridge shake, and it was pretty... We were okay where we lived in Woodland Hills, but up towards Northridge with this college and everything else, it got pretty bad with apartments and stuff. It was kind of real devastating.
For me, the recent one, the Sanders earthquake, I think it was called, in the San Gabriel Valley in Inland Empire, that was scary.
Yeah. What?
Which earthquake?
Was the Sanders? Was that the right word for it? I can't remember.
Silmar?
Landers.
Landers, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that was very big. That was
it was huge,
7.3 or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, Silmar's north of Northridge. But on record worldwide, what's the largest, if you know, the largest recorded earthquake?
The largest is 1960 Chile, 9.5. So just, you know, gigantic. And that was a subduction zone again. So we don't have that in most of California. So subduction zones can have much larger earthquakes because the fault is at such a low angle that you can have huge areas rupture all at once.
So a lot of people talk about tsunamis, right? And you know, in California, are we in big danger of that? Are there actually faults? You know, I know there are. I mean, that's a trick question, I guess. You know, offshore and out in the Pacific Ocean, adjacent to the California shoreline.
There are faults off the California shoreline. Some of them are more of a what we call strike slip motion, which is horizontal and unlikely to make a tsunami. But there are lots of little faults that. Could have earthquakes and could move the ocean floor vertically, which is what makes a tsunami. And you can also have earthquakes that generate ground motion that then causes underwater landslides off the coast, which causes tsunamis. This would all be like small-scale tsunamis compared to, say, if you're thinking like Japan, the huge tsunami that happened there.
But doesn't Hawaii have the same sort of thing with the plates that are going underneath each other?
They're in the middle of a plate. They do have earthquakes because of the volcanism there.
Right.
But they also just get nailed with tsunamis from earthquakes all around the Pacific Rim because they're just right in the middle of the ocean, nothing to break the waves. So they sometimes get nailed from, say, tsunamis from Alaska or from Japan.
Yeah, I just noticed on a recent trip in Northern California, we went up the coastline and Santa Cruz area and things like that, just a lot more signage than I expected to see for, you know, tsunami warnings or tsunami escape routes and things like that. They were everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're at the beach and you feel shaking, you should immediately go to high ground.
Right.
No matter what. Just to be safe. Wait till you see something.
Yeah, the same would apply down here in the L.A. Basin then, or Huntington Beach, or, you know, anywhere down there where the got low level land.
Definitely, just move inward and up if you feel shaky.
Inward and up, yeah.
Well, I bet a lot of people want to know why we have a statistical seismologist on the show, and when you get to the water part, because I think, you know, knowing all the things that you had just told us is very interesting, because people really don't understand all of those things behind it. You know, they just watch the the lady, I can't remember her name. It's on TV all the time. And
Lucy Jones,
yeah,
probably.
Lucy Jones. Yeah. And she always comes out. God, for years she's been doing it. I mean, I remember when the Northridge thing.
Right.
That's just, they plastered her name all over the place. Anyway.
Well, yeah, you feel a earthquake and you want to hear from Lucy Jones.
That's right. That's the goddess of that. But it's becoming more believed that man can initiate earthquakes. And I've been reading a lot on that, such as like in, let's take a couple areas, like oil production by injecting water into the ground. That, how does that affect or can initiate an earthquake?
Yeah, so there's tremendous amounts of wastewater that's produced by some of these oil and natural gas extraction techniques. And when they pump it back into the ground, it can basically change to something called pore pressure, which is the pressure of water inside rocks underground. And when you increase that pressure inside the rocks, you can actually decrease the friction on a fault. And if you decrease friction, it can move a lot easier. And so it can induce earthquakes. And it's involved in a method of wastewater injection has caused all sorts of earthquakes, particularly Oklahoma and Kansas.
Right.
In the last 10 years, there was a magnitude 5.7 earthquake in 2011, so it's pretty big. That was induced by wastewater injection caused by oil and natural gas extraction.
So what's the connection to fracking with that I've heard or read in the news reports?
So fracking is one of the ways to generate those huge volumes of wastewater.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting because fracking also itself can cause earthquakes. Like there's the magnitude 4s in Canada that's been caused by fracking, but typically it's where you inject the wastewater from the fracking that causes larger earthquakes, which is an important distinction because, for example, there's a lot of hydraulic fracturing in Pennsylvania, but due to regulations, they can't inject the wastewater in Pennsylvania. So they truck it across the border to Ohio and inject it there, and that's why there's a cluster of induced earthquakes near Youngstown, Ohio.
Wow.
That's
interesting.
It's not always right where the fracking is happening. No. That you would get the earthquake.
So when people go out to do this, when businesses go out to drill for oil and things of that sort, I would assume they have to go through some ecological hoops to get permits and things like that. Does a study, in your knowledge, does somebody have to go out and do a study, say, well, if we do this and inject this into here, it's a potential for causing an earthquake, or they just give them a permit to do it and say, you know, we'll worry about it afterwards?
Well, I know that I'm not totally an expert in that whole political side of it.
Yeah.
But I do know early in the fracking boom that it was much more unregulated than it is today. And, you know, in the early 2010s, you know, the Oklahoma seismicity rate was just going through the roof, orders of magnitude, you know, hundreds, thousands times.
Sure. Yeah.
More earthquakes than there used to be. And in the last few years, it's actually started to come down. And I think at least part of that, if it's not oil prices, is also that they have increased the regulations, although I'm not up to date on exactly what those regulatory framework is.
No, I mean, I would hope somebody would be thinking about that stuff before they say, yeah, go ahead and do what you want, and then cause this big earthquake because of it. So.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just, you know, any time you're injecting large amounts of fluid in the ground, you have the potential, if it's in a seismic area, you could induce earthquakes. It's actually not just hydrocarbon extraction that can be linked to it. There's actually green sources of energy that also produce earthquakes. So just in California, for example, we have a lot of geothermal energy production, for example, down at the Salton Sea, and that's been linked to earthquakes. So if you look at the production level over time, it fluctuates up and down, but right in track with the rate of earthquakes in that area too. And it's also an issue with some of the plans to sequester carbon underground so that, you know, we aren't putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, warming the planet. Some of the plans are to put the carbon underground, and that could also potentially trigger earthquakes if it's, you know, sufficient volumes in the wrong
place. Sure.
So if they want to, you know, everybody's trying to save water and, you know, finding new places to keep it aside from dams and such. So if they find a field that they want to make it an aquifer underneath, does a study have to be done? I don't know the regulations on that part of it, but to inject more water into the ground, you know, you can, and then when you see the reverse of that, when you pump it out and you get the subsidence and big holes and things, I mean, so it's like a no-win situation. You either put too much water in or you take too much water out.
Well, at least in Los Angeles, for example, they've really changed how they do oil extraction compared to how they did it in the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. They used to just, extract all the oil and not put anything back, and you had huge amounts of subsidence. And now they do, they basically equalize the pressure. So they put in water to replace the oil they're taking out, which mitigates both the subsidence and the seismic risk. Hmm.
Are there smaller influences, man-made influences, that can affect the probability of earthquakes? Like, for example, right, if you build this big old dam and you start damming and collecting the water, all that weight of the water, can it have an influence on an underlying fault?
Absolutely, and I think that's that may be the very first really clear example of, human-caused earthquakes was a dam. There was the 1966 earthquake in Italy. It was a magnitude 6.6 earthquake. That killed 177 people, and it was believed to be caused by the Coina Dam. So, again, the dam was built, the reservoir was filled, and as the reservoir was filled, it started to trigger earthquakes.
Wow.
And like you say, it's just the weight of the water that exerts a lot of forces down below. And if you have a fault that's oriented in, the wrong direction, basically, so it's, of course, it'll be hard to see that signal.
Right.
But, of course, you can actually see it from satellites. You can see, when we have droughts and all this, and there's less snowpack in the mountains, you can see the whole state of California basically move up because that weight has been removed. You can see from satellite images basically the whole state kind of rebound up.
Absolutely fascinating. that is just awesome.
No, it is. So I probably take it that there's really no way to minimize earthquakes.
We're talking about earthquakes caused by humans. So if there's any earthquake we can minimize, it would be those.
Right. But what about the other ones that we kind of know about with things of that? Is there a way to minimize the volcano activities and things like that that would help? I mean, I know it would involve digging down into the Earth's crust and so forth. But I mean, we just can't do anything? Is that kind of what it is?
There's really no stopping plate tectonics. Plate tectonics is driven by, the forces from the mantle pushing on the plates, and those are just, beyond anything that with current technology we could feasibly do.
Well, last thing, I enjoy talking with you. This is really interesting to me. I mean, I things I don't know about, and I want to learn a whole bunch more. But do you believe that the next big earthquake we're going to have is going to be exponentially larger than the Northridge quake?
No, I think the most likely thing is the next big damaging earthquake will be a moderate-sized earthquake like Northridge. So locally, it'll be a disaster, but it won't be the regional-scale disaster. That's just not as likely of a scenario. It's one we have to prepare for because we don't want a Katrina kind of situation to happen
in
Southern California. So even though that's the less likely scenario, it's one we talk about a lot because it would be so devastating.
Wow.
But I think it's important to emphasize that the more likely thing is something more like Northridge, and there's a lot we can do just to prepare for the more like typical earthquakes that we have from decade to decade.
Yeah. Real quickly, Morgan, some of our listeners want to learn a little bit more, can they go to anywhere on the U.S. Geological Survey website?
Yeah, go to earthquakes.usgs.gov, and there's a link to click to a map, and you can see all the earthquakes that are happening in Southern California every day.
Great. Well, we appreciate you coming on the show, and I sure learned a lot.
Yep, getting up to the 7 o'clock news hour. So
I didn't have that kind of physics when I went to school. We talked about acoustical physics, but that's awesome.
Thanks for coming on the show. Appreciate it very much.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, 106.5 FM, and now 102.